Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Acclaimed poet Patricia Jabe Wesley was born in Liberia, and she lived there until 1991 when she and her husband and three children immigrated to the United States to escape civil war. It was a 14-year event that took the lives of more than 200,000 people in her country. Since then, Patricia has earned a doctorate in creative writing and English from Western Michigan University in 2002. She now is an assistant professor of English and creative writing at the Pennsylvania State University's campus in Altoona, where she also lives. Patricia is in town today as part of the Ohio State University's Office of Research Symposium Series. She'll be speaking twice today. If you want to learn more about that, go to research.osu.edu/ORTEC. Welcome to the show, Patricia.
Thank you, and it's a privilege to be here.
Privilege is all mine. You know, you started writing poetry as a girl, about, as far as I could figure out, about 13 or 14 years old at the time.
Exactly.
Now you say that poetry heals and that a lot of your healing from the Civil War that you endured came from writing poetry, which is something you must have learned, though, as an adult. But you started writing poetry as a child. Where did that transition come in for you? When did it occur to you?
Well, I would say that the first time I probably discovered that poetry heals must have been when I was a girl, too, because I was brought up by a stepmother that I thought as a child, I always thought she was a witch because we didn't make it together. We were always fighting, and the way I would respond would be that I would go to the room and I would write a poem. And I would write a mean poem about her and about my father, and then I would feel good, you know, about myself. And so, but years of happiness, you know, after I grew up and got married and didn't contribute to the whole idea for a long time until I was caught up in the war. And I found out that at that point during the war, poetry was essential because I couldn't write prose. I always used to write prose too. And there was no time to compose prose in the running and the fighting and the bombing. And so I wrote poetry, but I found out that I was able to forget the bombing and the hurt that was going on in the war in the times I was writing. But then when I came to the United States, I had a lot of pain and I was crying and the war was still ongoing and there was so much disaster. So I decided to start writing my feelings down. And that's when I realized that after writing for almost 20 years in the United States, that now I can talk about these horrific experiences without crying because I've emptied my heart of most of the pain.
It dried up the tears.
Yes, I think so. The tears come every now and then.
Sure.
And when things remind me of the war, like Haiti reminded me of the war in Liberia. But most of my anger has been healed, and most of the pain is still being healed, but most of that is going away because I've emptied myself. And unfortunately, other people are reading what I've written and what I'm writing, and they are feeling the pain. I think I'm sharing the pain.
Is there anything wrong with that, though?
There is nothing wrong with that, because I believe that the world can help if the world knows that there is pain. And we saw that in Haiti, and we saw that even in our country, that many people didn't know that they were killing people and massacring babies and throwing them in the forest and for 14 years. And when the world got to know and people began to talk and the conscience of the world was, you know, awakened, then they did something about it. And that's why it's essential for someone to tell its story.
Now, Haiti was a natural disaster. Why did it remind you of what Liberians were doing in a civil war?
Because of the helplessness and the hopelessness of the situation. When war happens, civilians are helpless.
It's as if it's a natural disaster as far as it's as if.
And wars happen because, in a way, wars are a natural disaster. When poor people are trampled on and there's injustice and there's violence and perpetrated against poor people by leaders. And when war happens as a result of the discontent, yes, that's a natural thing. Human beings revolt. But that war took more then a revolting. It was cruel what those who came to save the people did and told the people in my country. It reminds me of Haiti because of the hopelessness. Because when we looked at a TV screen and I looked on the web and I saw how children, babies that had nothing to do with whatever the problem is or was in Haiti before, because we know that some of the people die as a result of misinformation. So I thought there were this kind of hopelessness where people are so awed by pain that they don't know what to do. That's what reminded me of my country.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Patricia Jabe-Wesley. She is an acclaimed poet from Liberia. She moved here in 1991 to escape with her husband and three children the civil war there. It lasted for 14 years and killed more than 200,000 people out of an actually relatively small population. There's only 1.5 million people.
The population was about 1.5 million to 2 million people when the war happened. I am one of those who dispute the
numbers.
They claim that 250,000 people died.
Okay.
When we moved to Grand Rapids from the war, from Monrovia, we were reading that 250,000 people had been killed. And then 14 years later, 13 years later, we were still reading that 250,000 people have been killed. Usually numbers are a United Nations way of finding a resolution of finding comfort in not doing anything to redeem and rescue people from dying. I believe there were about 500,000 Liberians dead by the end of the war as a result of the war and indirectly from the war. If you were a heart patient and you were caught up in a war, if you were a diabetic and you were caught up in a war where you had no food to eat and you had to run for days with no water, you didn't make it. Nobody was counting.
They only counted the people who were murdered, not who died as a result.
I don't even believe they were counting.
Okay.
I don't believe anybody counts, really, when people are killed. When truckloads of people are dumped in the water by a president who claimed to be fighting for his right, and by rebels who claim to be coming to redeem the people, Charles Taylor's rebels, nobody's counting. People are still looking for their relatives today.
You know, I read over a timeline of the history of the Civil War over and over and over again, trying to kind of get my arms around it. There were so many different factions. It had to be so confusing, at least from an outsider's point of view. From the inside, did it make any sense at all at the time?
Well, you see, human beings who have never seen war and have a misconception, and they have this romantic idea that war can bring solutions to problems. And so for a while, Liberians believed that there was salvation in Charles Taylor, you know. But what happened was that it didn't take long for us to know within a country that no war will solve Liberia's problems. So it didn't make sense. It didn't make sense for the government as well as the opposing factions to massacre innocent civilians by the thousands year after year. It didn't make sense. What I saw didn't make sense to me. And so I don't think anything was sensible to anybody. And one of the things that somebody listening to our discussion might want to ask is, isn't the war over? And why are academics and scholars still talking about the war? And that maybe that is something that I never asked myself, because I believe that the war is over. But the way in which we will not do it again is for us to know what we suffer, what we lost. When you have a bank account and that bank account is depleted overnight, you don't say, oh, man, oh, well, that's too bad. I don't have money again. You want to know how that money got robbed, you know, in the banks. So that's what I want. That's why I am interested as a poet in and finding out what women suffered, what women experienced. People are telling men's story.
I was going to say, why women particularly?
Well, because when I went through the war, I went through the war as a woman, and I saw the plight of women having no voice in planning or executing the war or the peace. And later on, women had a voice in bringing about peace, of course, but women were victimized on all sides because their men were either sent to war or could not go helping to look for food because they were targeted by the rebels and the soldiers. So women went out to look for food and were executed. Young girls were raped. Many women were killed. Many women were killed along with their children just because they had children. And when history recalls the stories of those who went through the war, they often forget the stories of women. And I was attracted to the fact that we are a unique group of people that have over and over been overlooked by history. And so I thought, I'm not interested in history. I'm interested in the ordinariness of the roles we women play in our ordinary situations of caring for children, of giving birth to children on the roadside, of being executed. And many women were raped who will never tell you that they were raped. So I wanted to discover how these women could tell their own stories on camera and how eventually I could develop a narrative and a documentary on that.
And that's your project. It's entitled They Tell Their Stories, Liberian Women's Trauma Stories from the Civil War.
Yes, that's my project that I was engaged in, supported by my university, because I couldn't get external funding. It's very difficult for a poet to go out looking for money from National Science Foundation or all of that, or the NEH. So I got little funding from my university, and I researched the stories of women in three major American cities, in New York, in Philadelphia, and in Minneapolis, St. Paul, you know. And those stories are on camera. They will break your heart. You cannot listen to 20 minutes of those stories without breaking down. And then I went to Ghana, Accra, Ghana, and also to Liberia.
Refugee camps there.
Yeah, yeah. In 2008, I also went to Monrovia, where, you know, I was speaking to women in Monrovia. I documented the stories of women across an economic, social, ethnic, and religious boundaries. So I talked to a minister of government who is now Minister of Information in Monrovia. I spoke to the president of my high school, College of West Africa, and they call him president. That's one of the most, if not the most, prestigious high school. Yeah, mm-hmm. I talked to her and about her experiences during the war. I talked to a university vice president who was a woman, and I talked to market women. I talked to poor, rich, and all kinds of women to hear their stories. I talked to a veteran grade school teacher who had returned. But this is what I discovered, and talking to women, I discovered that women tell their stories differently. A woman will tell you, even if she didn't have a child killed in the war, she will tell you about how she watched the killing of other people's babies, and she will cry over them, and she'll talk about the things happening around her. And a man will tell you how he was caught and killed, or how he was caught and suffered, you know, and tortured. And a woman will tell you more about how she watched the suffering of others.
We're going to have to take a quick break. My guest is Patricia Ajabe-Wesley. She is a poet. She's also a poetry and creative writing professor at Pennsylvania State University. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Tiger Woods has put sex addiction into headlines. Is it real? Can it be treated? We'll ask. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point begins this afternoon at 1 o'clock right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 24 degrees in downtown Columbus. Cloudy skies today with scattered snow showers, a high of 30 degrees. A little more snow tonight, less than an inch of accumulation, and a low of 17 degrees for tonight.
Support for WOSU comes from SAFI, Specialized Alternatives for Families and Youth, envisioning the day when every child is part of a loving family and is able to reach his or her greatest potential. Information is online at safy.org.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Patricia Jabe-Wesley. She is an acclaimed poet, multiple award-winning poet. She was born in Liberia and lived there until 1991 when she and her husband and three children emigrated to the United States. She moved, first of all, to Grand Rapids, Michigan, my hometown, which was a little bit of a surprise to me last night when I was reading about it. And you wrote quite a bit about Michigan, actually, in your poetry, and that made me feel a little homesick myself. So you want to read something now, Patricia?
Yes, and yes, interesting. And Michigan is my other home. And I'm going to be reading a poem here that Anne likes, and poem written from a single snapshot. Poem written from a single snapshot from The River is Rising, which is my third book published by Autumn House Press. On the beach in Monrovia, my children and I are building sand castles. You can see the Atlantic's waves in the distance, fighting for a place to roll their way onto shore. Waves are flapping in the wind as the tide rises up and down. Before we know it, we are in the middle of water. Bise is 2 years old. Empty, who is only 6 months, clings his short arm around my knee. He's staring at Bise and the sand castle she's erecting with her right foot. This is how my mother taught me to build a sand castle. You put your foot down and build mounds around it until this castle becomes stable. This is how we search for home. You put your foot down in a place long enough, that new place becomes home.
Thank you. That new place becomes home. Grand Rapids became home for a time. Why Grand Rapids? Michigan. Why? Why'd you move there?
Well, one of the things that people who have experienced trauma, war, violence will tell you is that when you are in trouble, those who come to rescue you and give you a place to hide are family. They become family. And so when we were caught up in the war for 2 years, before that, 3 years prior, we used to sponsor missionaries from the United States to our country through the InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. And we actually housed a missionary adult and a student in our home. And we housed like 22 others in the homes of our friends and other and professional people in Monrovia, because my husband and I were leaders of what we call the Christian Graduates Fellowship of a sister movement like IVCF. And so we were coordinators and helping with their mission. And so, but in 3 years, we had hosted over 60 Americans. So during the war, these Americans were struggling to help us get out of the war. And so when they got the first chance during the first ceasefire, they helped us get out. And we found out that a family that had lived with us and Ben Hosted, the leader of that group, Dan Denk in Michigan, Grand Rapids, Michigan, was willing to pull us up, our family of five, with small children, destitute, no clothes to wear, nothing, for 5 months in his home. and he became family. And Michigan adopted us. Grand Rapids came out for us. And I can still remember faces of those who wept with us. And so we lived in Michigan for 12 years before we branched out and moved to Pennsylvania. So that place became our pillow for our tears. And we are emotional about our connection to Michigan. But one of the things that draws me to Michigan and it's the lakes.
Mm-hmm.
The first time I saw Lake Michigan, I wept because it reminded me of the Atlantic Ocean. And I actually went down on my knees and grabbed a handful of water and tasted it. I wanted to be sure I was in at the Atlantic Ocean. And I discovered it was not salty. It was...
Grand Rapids is about 45 miles east of Lake Michigan.
From Kalamazoo or from most places in West Michigan, Western Michigan, you will notice that you only have to drive 30 to 40 minutes to get to a lake, a major lake.
A very, very big blue lake. If you would like to speak to Patricia, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you're just joining us, my guest is Patricia Jabe-Wesley. She is the poet, and she teaches creative writing and English at the Pennsylvania State University's campus in Altoona, where she lives. She is in Columbus today as part of the Ohio State University's Office of Research Symposium Series. She'll be speaking twice today. For more information on that, go to research.osu.edu/ORTEC or tech. You wrote another poem. A lot of the poems that I read last night, and I didn't want to try to absorb the entire book in one evening, but it was clear from what I did read from The River Is Rising, a lot of them were about the immigrant experience. And they also at the same time talked about where you were at the time. It wasn't just about where you'd come from, but about where you were. And another poem I read in the book Becoming Ebony, I believe, was called, well, maybe it was in The River Is Rising. It was called Broken World. And you had a line in there. You said, sometimes I can feel my skin slowly becoming American. And I think it's in Broken World.
Yeah.
Would you mind reading that or part
of
that?
Yes. I wrote this poem one of the Super Bowls, and my kids were watching Super Bowl, and I was watching
because they were watching.
But then at the end of all of the game, I discovered that a plane had crashed in Abidjan. And so I'm always in America, but half of my heart is in Africa. And so I began to cry because if a plane crashed in Abidjan, which is our next door neighbor in Liberia, I could be sure that not only and different people had died, but Liberians had also died in a plane crash of 169 people. So usually I turn to poetry when I'm grieving. So I wrote Broken World, and you can see some of the anger of the war in the poem. And Broken World. To every winning team, many more will lose. Many defenders, goalies, linebackers, dribblers, attackers, ball catchers, and now one lone winning cup from which no one will ever drink. To every war, there are no winners. To every living, many more dead will go unmarked. So many lives line up for death. So much of what took forever to build goes up in some cloud. So many buried alive or executed, a stray bullet accidentally passing. So many players who never knew the name of the game they played, yet they played without even knowing they were playing until someone found them dead by the roadside. Today, here are St. Louis Rams walking away with the Super Bowl, carrying the Super Trophy. Tennessee watches with a tearful eye. But below the deep Atlantic in Abidjan, a plane has just gone down. 169 gone down. And all this time, I was here watching what Americans call Super Bowl. I do not know the game. It is not even my game to lose or win. But my heart pounds hard for the game. Sometimes I can feel my skin slowly becoming American. Is life a game you can win or lose? Will winning warlords ever know the extent to which they have lost their war? How can anyone count those who have won and those who have lost our war? How can anyone travel from town to town, from country to country, from refugee camp to refugee camp, counting our living? How could we dig up each shallow mass grave for all the tens of thousands who were never counted? Why should anyone want to count at all? Show me the trophies of our war, so I will take you to a field where all the massacre still gather at night to bind open bullet wounds, even though they are already dead. When warriors come home from war carrying in their hands trophies of booty, all the bullets from their weapons gone, do we ask them to show us their scars? The after-war Dokla, with all its drumming and dancing, was never meant to be merry, not even in their jubilation at victory. You have only to watch the dancing warriors' feet to know.
You know, in the midst of Super Bowl season, and we just wrapped it up, it was an interesting... Did those images occur to you during your first Super Bowl, or had you already seen many Super Bowls at that point?
I don't think I up to
or
that
has
point.
The last
I,
one you I, ever watched?
No. I am since moving to Pennsylvania, I don't miss watching Super Bowl, or watching most football games. I'm a Steelers fan.
Okay,
I love the Steelers. I got their flag and everything. But when I was in Michigan, I watched because my two middle kids were becoming teenager, and the other was behind him 4 years, and they loved football and basketball, and so we watched as a family. And so, you know, I didn't watch most of the game. I was in and out, and sometimes I would be reading a book while I'm watching. So it was during that time. But when I saw the merriment, all the jubilation, and at church everybody was talking about going to the Super Bowl, and I thought, you know, yes, all this celebration going on here, and look at the pain going on somewhere else. But then I was able to make the connection and of the war. And I think that's what happens to our experiences. We develop new lenses year after year, and we begin to see the world through the lenses that life has handed us. And that's... I hope I'm not talking too much metaphor.
No.
I'm always speaking metaphors.
No. Sometimes I call it the prism. You see it through a different prism or a lens or something like that.
Yeah.
It casts a different color. It casts a different shadow. It casts a different, you know, it just, you don't see it the same way ever again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I just thought, you know, the Super Bowl is a quintessential American sport.
Yeah.
And comparing that or contrasting that with war.
Yeah, and also is to me, I don't understand my own poetry, but when people begin to give me their own wisdom like you're doing now, then I begin to understand. What I see is that I was able to say this is an American thing, and I'm beginning to enjoy something that is not African. Nobody thinks football is football, you know, outside of America. The thing is, soccer is football. But here I was beginning to enjoy football the American way. And I said, oh, this is like I am beginning to heal. And still reflecting on the pain. And this is where I am. Yeah.
If you'd like to speak to Patricia Jabi-Wesley, give us a call, 614 614- 292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Sorry, I just missed that last caller. Patricia, on your website, you write about survival, and you say that it's not just about being alive after a tragedy. It's more than just life, that it's about laughing again.
Yes, and then I will go back to Haiti, because Haiti is the most practical, most recent experience Americans have to tragedy, you know, connection to tragedy. And survival is not just being alive after the horrific experience of a tragedy. Survival is about getting up, moving on, and being able to keep yourself alive after survival. And we see that today. We saw it in Haiti, that many people survived in the tragedy, the earthquake, but will they live again? And so for me, surviving the civil war, there are many, many Liberians who survived the civil war and didn't survive, in my understanding, because they were unable to go on psychologically. They were able to remake their lives, unable to forgive and live again. And I believe that living again, it's not how much you fall or how often you fall, it's how you get up, how you stay up, and that matters. And I'm not saying those who don't get up are to be condemned, but I'm encouraging people to get up,
We have to take a short break. Then we'll return with Patricia Jabe-Wesley. If you would like to speak with her, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Just a reminder, Patricia is speaking twice today at Ohio State University for the research the Research Symposium Series, or the Office of Research Symposium Series. You can learn more about that. Go to research.osu.edu/ORTEC. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Corporate partners help provide support for WOSU 820. Your business can join them and reach an educated, engaged, appreciative audience every day. Your business will also be associated with a trusted source for national and local news, arts, and culture. For more information, contact Christine Schottich at 247-4469. And thanks for supporting WOSU 820, NPR News.
And you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides will be here. As the Winter Olympic Games near closing day, we'll hear an amazing true story of friendship among Americans and Canadians that grew out of the 9/11 tragedy and exemplifies the base of Olympian values of building a better world. That discussion begins at 11 right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 25 degrees in downtown Columbus, cloudy skies with scattered snow showers today and a high of 30. Clouds tonight with a good chance of snow overnight, less than an inch of accumulation, a low of 17 degrees. Snow showers for Friday, and less than an inch of accumulation, a high of 28 for Friday. And remember to get access to WOSU anytime at WOSU.org. Hear the latest updates from NPR and WOSU News from the convenience of your computer by streaming on the web. Listen online at WOSU.org. All Sides continues on WOSU 820.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Patricia Jabe-Wesley. She's a poet, and she teaches creative writing and poetry at Pennsylvania State University in Altoona, where she lives with her husband and now four children. Right, Patricia?
Yeah.
We have a call right now. If you'd like to speak to Patricia, give us a call. 614-292-8513. And David, you are on the air with Patricia.
Yeah. Hi, Patricia.
Hello, David.
Yeah. Hi. I'm from Africa also. Immigrated here like long time ago. Like so many Africans come to United States because they are affected by war, one way or the other. Do you know, I would just want to ask you if there are any, like, African organizations within the United States that kind of, like, you know, organized Africans who are affected by war, kind of like we're talking about to heal, or even, you know, at least have some kind of solution back home or whatever. Is there any kind of organization that, like that that you know of?
Not that I know of, but this is a very neat question from you, because maybe you and I can begin to put that kind of group together, because we have tens of thousands of immigrants from all over, from Somalia, from Ethiopia, Eritrea, from West Africa, all over West Africa, Sierra Leone. I have a lot of scholarly friends who are here as a result of the wars in West Africa. So, yes, I think we need an organization like that, and it would be good for us to put together something like that. I'm seriously going to think about that. There might be an organization. I'm going to start searching the web, but I doubt it. I know there are scholarly organizations. There are country and tribal organizations. And we need that, because from Liberia, many Liberians are very angry. And in their organizations, there have been lots of infighting, and you can see anger. People who are psychiatrists will understand that kind of anger. And I always wonder why people are constantly fighting one another in these organizations. But when you dig down, you will notice, you will know that this is because they are angry about all they have lost: home, property, family, and it is a sad thing. Yes, I see your point. And you can always find me on the web. If you can't find me, go to my university website. Everybody can find me now on the web. So if you want to, you are interested in such an organization, I think we can put one together. Even if you're not, I'm going to investigate.
Okay. And what's your website again?
Oh, my website, just go to pjabe.com. And I also have a blog that is devoted to a lot of the issues I'm talking about and other lighter issues. But if you check Penn State University and you get my name, Patricia Jabe Wesley, even if you say Patricia Wesley, you will find me.
And David, we're going to post a link to Patricia's website on WOSU.org/allsides.
All right. Well, thank you, guys.
Yeah, thank you, David.
Bye-bye.
In 2008, Patricia, you testified as an expert witness for Advocates for Human Rights, Truth, and Reconciliation Commission of Liberia's diaspora hearings on the Liberian Civil War. What was that like?
Yes. In fact, I think I misquoted the actual name of the... It was the Liberian Truth Commission... Truth and Reconciliation Commission hearing hosted by Advocates for Human Rights. That's how I should,
okay.
Yeah. In Minneapolis, St. Paul. I was invited by Advocates and the commission.
And that was in Minneapolis?
In Minneapolis, okay. St. Paul, at Hamline University. I think that's how to pronounce the name. And it was a grueling experience. It was very difficult. I think what it did for me was to teach me a little bit of a lesson about my own pill that I give to women who I make testify to me in my research. Yeah,
to have to talk about what hurts.
And, yeah. And I went to there were dozens of Liberians invited and encouraged to come in and testify, and had a really big schedule for days. I think I got in on the second or third day due to my own schedule. And I was able to sit through maybe two or three testimonies. And I broke down over and over when others were testifying. And highlights of my time was when a woman called Marie Var was interview. I was the first to get her rape story out of her. I feel good that I was able to get that story out of her. I have an hour and a half documentation of her story on camera. And so when advocates needed her, they needed to talk to me about inviting her, because many women were not willing to talk about their rape. And we had to work to get Marie to be encouraged to come and testify for them. So when she testified, I felt like I was connected to her, like a kinship, and because I first heard her story, and it's part of my project. So, but then I had to take this stand, and I discovered, well, even though they thought I was in very much control, and they thought I knew the dates, and they thought, I realized, if you read the documentation on the web, or if you watch the video, I was crying, I was short of words, I was stammering, and I even forgot some names. I got home and I realized I still remember some names. But I broke down over and over because it was difficult.
And this was many, many years after you had left.
Yeah, it was in 2008, June.
And you could only really talk about what you'd witnessed yourself.
Yeah, I also decided not to talk too much about, because I knew they were going to publish it, and I knew. And now you go on the web and say, and Dr. Patricia Jabez Wesley answers the commission, you know. So I thought I wanted to say exactly what I wanted to say. I was very organized. I didn't want to give up my own research to them, mm-hmm. you know. But even the little I told them was difficult to tell. It was difficult to make sense of what we experience. And the reason this war needs to be documented, and one of the most important reasons, is because what happened in Liberia was not a war. It was violence against humanity. And there was no reason why the war was fought the way it was fought. People were slashed to death and killed, and women were split open to take their babies, their fetuses out of them in public, and nobody is being held responsible. I think this is one of my reasons for continuing to write about it, because up to today, nobody is being tried by anybody about the injustices and the human rights abuses and the torture Liberians experience. Even the warlord Charles Taylor is being tried in The Hague only because of his crimes against Sierra Leone.
He
financed the war, but he also supported the war in every way. And mm-hmm. Our government, the Liberian government, has not brought charges against Charles Taylor, and the commission's recommendations have not been heeded by anybody in the government, and there are former warlords who are senators and representatives.
Now, why is that? Why don't they?
Because,
as far as you understand.
Because people don't take Africa seriously. Because Africans don't take themselves seriously. Because human rights maybe should not be valued in Africa. That's how I take it. If I'm being sarcastic, that's what I feel, that people need to be charged. And what I heard, that the United States might bring charges against naturalized Liberians who were and involved in the war. I don't know how far that's going to go. That's because Charles Taylor's son is in prison, and he's been convicted because he was an American citizen when he tortured people in Liberia. So, wow, if we can punish Liberians who are American citizens, I think we need to also punish Liberians who were Liberian citizens when they committed the atrocities against humanity.
I think, in reading about your project, it was difficult, and it's difficult to know really what to ask and what to ask about something like that. But you reunited with your sister-in-law after 20 years, and she had lived through the entire Civil War, mm-hmm. and also was still in a refugee camp when you found her. And what was that like?
I would say accidentally, because I knew I was going to Accra, Ghana, but it was accidental because I after I knew I was going to Accra, Ghana, I decided, okay, I will continue my project in Ghana because I didn't know how I would find the money to go to Ghana. So I was invited as a poetry faculty for the Pan-African Literary Forum in conjunction with New York University. They had a project, and we took maybe dozens of students from the United States and all over Africa. So we may have had over 150 participants. And so I was teaching, and for 2 weeks, it should have been 3 weeks, but I had my project go on to Liberia. So one of my objectives was to go to the refugee camp and talk to people, interview people, and visit with people. And we took a trip out of town the day before my trip to the refugee camp. We went to see the slave castles, a very grueling experience too. And on the way there, I didn't notice the refugee camp. And then we were coming back, and then somebody was talking and said, Patricia, did you see the Liberian refugee camp on the way here? I said, no. And they said, well, we'll point to it when we get it. And when they pointed to it, I broke down on the bus. I cried on the bus. I cried because I could not imagine that Liberia was now free and Liberians were still in refugee camp on a highway in Accra, Ghana. And people on the bus were trying to comfort me, and they were mostly Americans and other internationals. So the next day, I prepared for my big trip to the refugee camp. My sister-in-law was excited to see me. She's a 33-year-old young woman who had gone to refugee camp and almost 20 years before. And so I went to see her. She had prepared to leave. Her husband had already gone back to Liberia on the order of the UN that Liberians should go home. There was nothing waiting for them at home. And so many of them refused to go home. There were, at a certain point, there were 45,000 Liberian refugees very close to the city, about an hour's drive from the city, and still isolated from life in Accra. And so I went in there, and her entire little shack, they were in this little shanty town, and you can see on the photograph on the web.
Right.
And everything in her house was gone. She had to go out and get a bench for me to sit on, and my
they'd already moved her stuff out, or
yeah,
okay.
They were all on a truck ready to go home. She was preparing, and I was encouraging her to go home earlier. Her sisters had sent money to take her back to Monrovia. They had prepared a place for her because she was lucky. She had family that came. She was the baby of the family. Mm-hmm. And so we spent a lot of time crying and talking. And we took photos. And then I left and went to Liberia. The next day, you know, I couldn't talk to her about the war. I saw the war. I couldn't interview the women about the war. The people I talked to were mostly concerned about being uprooted so fast and being forced to go. And so I couldn't do the kind of, I couldn't record. I did audio recording because it seemed cruel to do video recording and in that situation. One of the things about doing research is you have to be very flexible and understanding. So I thought, she's going to go to Liberia, and I'm going to go back to Liberia to interview her. And so we did audio recording, mostly crying because her mother died in a while she was in refugee camp, and she lost her brother while she was in refugee camp, and she never saw these people. So we returned. I went to Liberia and worked on my research for 2 weeks. And 2 weeks after I got there, one morning, my brother-in-law showed up at my door and to tell me that she had died. And I think she must have died of brain aneurysm from all the things. I think she was too traumatized. And she just started acting strange and couldn't be controlled. And the thing is, something ruptured in her brain or something. So, and there was almost no medical facilities for refugees. So she died in a small little clinic. And the saddest part was her father is now dead. He died last year, October at 94. And for me to visit him at his place, my husband and I were also, my husband was also on our trip on his own, separate trip. And when I went to see him, and he asked me, he said, my daughter you came, and because I took the photos we took together, she and I, and I did a little family show to show the pictures, and everybody, oh, she looks good. You know, everybody was excited. She was coming home in about 3 weeks. And then my father-in-law said, you came and you showed me my daughter's photos. You didn't tell me she was going to die, you know, before coming home. And so that was the experience. It was a very difficult experience. It still is. And she has a sister who she's next to, the many, but she was very close to this one because Concetta Wesley was also in the refugee camp with her before the United Nations pulled her out. And my sister-in-law wanted to come to America. She didn't want to go to Liberia after waiting for 15 years on the list to be and brought to America with her sister that she was close to. And so she didn't want to go to Liberia. And in a way, dying was a healing for her because I don't think she wanted to go back to the country that she felt had abandoned her. And so maybe that was the best thing for her to go, you know. So, and they had to take her body back to Liberia, and she had a good burial because she had a lot of siblings who did love her a lot. Yeah,
I think about that trauma. And you know, the whole idea when you talked about building a home and your foot in the sand, and it's where you put your foot and where it can stay. And she must have felt maybe like that was her home too. And
yeah, she wanted to either be in Ghana or come to the United States. Mm-hmm. And I can understand refugees who wait for 15 years and to be taken to a different place of refuge, and who are so traumatized by war that they don't want to go back. And some people don't understand that. I understand that.
Thank you so much for joining me, Patricia. I've really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you so much. It is my privilege and honor to be here at Ohio State, especially coming from where I came from, that far away and that close.
Well, some people might say you mean Penn State, but
I'm from Penn State.
My guest has been the acclaimed poet, Patricia Jabe Wesley. She's from Liberia. She's been telling us about her experiences. You can hear more about that today. She's speaking twice at Ohio State. You can get more on that from going to WOSU.org/allsides. We have links. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.